Welcome to the Deep Dive. It's April 27th, 2025.
And today we're doing our usual thing, digging into the front page of the HN Pod.
Yeah, hacker news, basically, but in audio form. It's our way of giving you a quick handle on what's buzzing in the tech world.
Exactly. That's always such a grab bag, isn't it? Today's no different. We got some cool projects, a bit of retro tech.
Some real-world software problems, definitely. And even something unexpected about creativity.
Yeah, that one caught my eye.
So the rundown for today, there's this remote-controlled IKEA Death Star lamp, which honestly sounds amazing.
It does.
Then a tutorial on programming text adventures in C. Takes you back, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Also, something called Shardines using Squalite for multi-tenant apps.
Uh-huh. Database stuff.
And this piece arguing you should read the obits for creativity.
Intriguing title.
And finally, a look at why reverse geocoding is, well, apparently quite hard.
Ah, yeah. Fun times with maps and addresses. Or not so fun, maybe.
Right. So let's dive in and see what nuggets we can pull out.
Let's start with the lamp. The IKEA Death Star lamp.
Okay, so the base idea isn't new, right? People have been painting that IKEA PS 2014 lamp to look like the Death Star for ages.
Yeah, it's a pretty well-known hack. Right. It looks surprisingly good, actually, for just a paint job.
But this project, the one on the HN Pod front page, takes it way further.
How so?
They've motorized it. So instead of pulling the strings to open and close the aperture bits, it's remote controlled now, and it's using ES Home firmware.
Oh, cool. So ES Home, that means it probably integrates with smart home systems.
Exactly. The post mentions Home Assistant specifically.
Nice. So you could like automate it with other things.
Totally. And get this, there's a sundial feature.
A sundial feature on a Death Star lamp.
Yeah. Apparently the lamp's opening adjusts based on the sun's elevation during the day. There's even a time-lapse video.
Huh. That's surprisingly practical, almost. Was that the main goal, do you think? Or just the cool factor?
Good question. It's hard to say, but the creator isn't done yet.
Oh, what else?
The ultimate goal is apparently to make the stepper motor play the Imperial March.
No way. Like the Floppatron, the floppy drive orchestra.
Exactly like that. You know, you just have to admire the commitment.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So what did the Hacker News comments make of all this?
Well, the usual mix. Someone pointed out the original lamp isn't actually very bright. So, you know, maybe not the best reading lamp.
Right, the classic form versus function trade-off in DIY.
But the creator actually uses it in their home theater. It closes and dims when a movie starts.
Oh, that's clever.
And then opens back up when you pause. Pretty neat atmosphere setting.
Yeah, I like that. Any other takes?
Someone with a copper-coated interior said it worked fine as a dining table light. So maybe the inside finish matters a lot for brightness.
Makes sense.
Another person liked the remote closing for a different reason. A gradual brightening in the morning, like a sunrise alarm clock.
Huh. Never thought of that.
And of course, IKEA assembly woes came up. One user hated the hook system, how it just dangles.
Yes, the dangling lamp cord.
But someone else jumped in saying, well, that hook system is totally standard in Sweden.
Cultural differences in ceiling fixtures. Always fun.
Someone suggested an adapter for track lighting, which seems sensible.
Yeah, practical.
And inevitably, someone asked about customizing the firmware to sync the opening and closing to music, like a visualizer.
Of course. Gotta have the music sync.
The timing was good, too, hitting the HM Pod just before May the 4th.
That's right.
And there was this really detailed comment appreciating the original lamp design. Someone even shared a story about modifying X-Wing T-chains. Real fan dedication there.
It taps into that Star Wars fandom pretty deep.
Though someone else offered a different interpretation, when it's open and lit red, it looks like an exploding Death Star with X-Wings escaping.
Ooh, I can kind of see that. It's all in how you look at it.
And here's a really surprising detail from the comments. Apparently, this lamp might have played a role in the bankruptcy of its Hungarian manufacturer.
What?
How? The price point was supposedly just too low, unsustainable.
Wow, that's kind of dark for a lamp story.
Yeah.
A reminder of the economics behind these things.
Yeah. And another connection, someone mentioned it resembles the first boss in the game Rez. Apparently, the game designer Circle even noticed it back then.
Okay, that's obscure, but cool. These things pop up in unexpected places.
There was even a debate on whether it really looks like the Death Star. Some see it instantly, others not so much.
It's definitely suggestive, I'd say.
And the most relatable comment, someone nicknamed theirs the Dust Star.
Huh. Yeah, I can imagine those panels are dust magnets. Very practical concern.
And briefly, on the tech side, a mini debate about video formats VP9 versus H.264 for the demo video and playback issues.
Ah, the joys of web video codecs. Still a thing.
And just to round it off, a quick mention of GitLab because, well, it's hacker news.
Right. Can't escape the platform debates.
Okay, moving on. From futuristic lamps to very retro gaming, how to program a text adventure in C.
Yes, by Rude Helderman. MIT licensed, which is nice.
First thing to note, it's not a Learn C tutorial. It assumes some programming basics already.
Right. It's more about the game structure.
Mm.
But text adventures. Wow, that takes me back to the 80s. They were huge.
They really were. Seems kind of primitive now next to modern graphics, but there's still a really active, interactive fiction community.
Yeah, people are still making them with free tools. It's fascinating, that persistence. Maybe it's the creative constraint.
Could be. The author's main advice, though, if you do want to write one, use a dedicated system. Don't necessarily start from scratch in C unless you really want that challenge.
Makes sense. Those systems handle a lot of the boilerplate, like parsing commands and managing inventory.
So the big question, why C then, if there are better tools?
Well, the author says it's entertaining, it's challenging, educational. And for them, it's familiar. Plus, that close to the metal feeling.
Right, like the old school developers working with tight memory limits. A bit of a retro challenge.
Exactly. But they also stress that the core concepts, state management, input handling, game structure, you learn to doing this in C. Yep. They apply everywhere, Java, Python, whatever.
Good point. The tutorial itself is incremental. Starts super simple, like a 9-line hello world.
And builds up step by step to a full game. The key thing they emphasize is the descriptive text. That's your graphics engine, basically.
Painting pictures with words. So what did the HN crowd think?
Lots of interesting comments. Someone mentioned porting the original Colossal Cave Adventure to TADES back in 93.
Wow.
And then Graham Nelson ported that to Inform. The commenter basically argued Inform is probably the best tool for writing these games today.
But people still saw the value in doing it in C for learning.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
The pedagogical value was widely acknowledged. It really forces you to understand fundamentals.
There was also excitement about using modern AI, like LLMs for NPCs.
Yeah, imagine text adventure characters you could actually have a proper conversation with powered by something like Llama. That could be amazing.
People shared stories of getting lost in Colossal Cave or trying to remake old games like Drug Wars with LLMs, that mix of nostalgia and new tech.
Someone linked to StoryHarp, a tool for kids to make speech interactive, choose your own adventures, shows the range of tools out there.
Then it got pretty technical. Could you run Inform games on old 8-bit machines?
Right. Mentions of Puny Inform and ZIL, the language Infocom used. Deep cuts there.
And a funny comment. Maybe a text adventure is all you need for hit in 2025. Comparing Doom to a text game with fewer verbs.
A slight exaggeration, perhaps.
A really important thread was about writing good content for these games. It's not just coding.
No, it's like novel writing, but interactive. Aaron Reed's 50 Years of Text Games got recommended for History and Ideas.
Plus lots of specific advice. Using scripting languages like Inc, thinking about branching narratives, player agency.
Avoiding leading questions. The Inform Designer's Manual came up. And Crimes Against Mimesis, and Ron Gilbert's classic essay, Why Adventure Games Suck.
Clearly, there's a real craft to it. It's not just about the parser.
And the distinction was made between text adventures and graphical ones. Mm. The linearity, the constraints, which again, can fuel creativity. The term interactive fiction, or IF, is the standard term.
Links to the IF wiki, blog posts on nonlinear dialogue, and the fact that old game books are on the Internet Archive. Handy.
The recurring advice was, use an authoring system first. Don't reinvent the wheel unless you really want to learn about wheels.
Inc and RenPy got shoutouts as good systems. RenPy is more visual novel focused, but adaptable.
People shared MUD development stories too, those old multiplayer text games.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the idea of LLMs for dynamic NPCs and quests in MUDs, it keeps coming up.
Someone actually wrote a text adventure in C as a planning step before coding it in Z80 assembly for a ZX Spectrum.
Whoa, now that's dedication. Talk about close to the metal.
But the idea of writing a domain-specific language, DSL, in C first, like Infocom did, also came up.
Yeah, build the tool to build the game.
Specific C coding tips. Watch out for straw talk.
Oh God, straw talk. Nightmares.
Right. Focus on the UI, use preprocessor defines, be careful with conditionals. Someone even mentioned ANSI color parser trauma.
The pain is real. Text serialization too. Not fun.
Looking forward, someone wanted procedurally generated text games about economics and politics. Ambitious.
Very. Probably needs AI.
Yeah.
Then the really geeky suggestions. Embed a Lisp interpreter in C and write the game in Lisp.
Why Lisp?
Arguments about it being maybe more natural than OO for this, mentioning entity component systems, ECS architecture.
Okay, getting deep now. Using Lex and Yak with C for parsing also suggested.
More Strat PTSD was shared. And a mention of Section 9 using awk for code generation. And comparisons to LPMUD. Wow, a real deep dive into text game history and tech.
Okay, let's shift from game dev nostalgia to current software architecture challenges. Shardines, SQLite3 database per tenant with active record.
Right, so this is about multi-tenant applications, apps serving multiple customers or tenants built with Ruby on Rails active record.
And the idea is instead of one big database with everyone's data mixed together but separated by a tenant ID, you give each tenant their own separate SQLite database file.
Exactly. And the author highlights some benefits, like updates. If you update one tenant's database and it messes up, it doesn't break things for anyone else.
Okay, that makes sense. Isolation.
And data destruction. If a tenant leaves, you just delete their file. Poof, data gone. No risk of leaving remnants in a shared database.
That sounds clean. What about deployments?
They plan to have routing switch users to a new app instance pointing at the updated database file after a migration. Kind of like a blue-green deployment, but at the database file level.
Interesting approach. How did Hacker News react? Skeptical.
Well, lots of questions, definitely.
Yeah.
Can you run migrations for multiple tenants at once? Probably. Limited by disk.io.
But the big question I imagine was, why not just use Postgres?
Bingo. Why not Postgres with row-level security, RLS? That gives you isolation within a single database.
Or, as someone else suggested, Postgres with a schema per tenant.
Yeah, that was floated as a middle ground, offers logical separation, but warnings about hitting limits if you have thousands of schemas in one Postgres instance.
So it's a scaling concern.
Potentially. Then there was this interesting discussion. Does this pattern suggest a weakness in traditional databases? Like, should they be better at unloading index data for inactive users from memory?
Kind of like the whole Mongo versus Postgres debate, but for multi-tenancy memory usage?
Sort of.
Mm-hmm.
But then counter-arguments. Maybe tenant databases do fit in memory easily, and you might lose benefits of prefetching and page caching you get with one big database file.
So the core debate is still, is this really better than just a tenanted column and shared tables? You need a strong reason to go with DB per tenant.
Right. Though a good point was made. Just because a pattern isn't common doesn't mean it's bad. New patterns emerge all the time.
True. Apparently, this isn't totally new either. Someone mentioned a RailsConf talk from 2012 about it.
Yeah, by James Edward Gray. And a similar project for Elixir called PhoebeDB exists.
So the trade-off seems to be better isolation versus potentially more disk network I/O overhead.
That seems to be the crux of it. Maybe it works best if tenant means single user or single session.
Someone wished Active Record had something like Core Data's managed object contexts to hide the complexity of which database you're talking to.
That'd be nice. A big operational headache mentioned was keeping the database schema in sync across all those separate files.
Oh, yeah. Migrations would be a pain. You change a table structure, you have to apply it to potentially hundreds or thousands of files.
Exactly. Which is why Postgres RLS looked appealing to some isolation without the schema sync nightmare.
You'd need good tooling for the SQLite approach to manage migrations, maybe block writes during updates.
Definitely. Someone linked to a Crunchy Data article explaining Postgres RLS for multi-tenancy.
And just for color, someone randomly asked why it was sad that the post was about Ruby.
Huh. Gotta love those language tribalism moments. Just dot code people. Okay, topic 4. This one's different. An article from MIT Press Reader, also highlighted in the NYT, then on HN Pod. Read the obits.
Subtitle, The Creativity Hack No One Told You About.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What's the hack?
The argument, by Keith Sawyer, is that reading obituaries, specifically the short ones about ordinary, non-female people, can boost your creativity.
Oh, That seems counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Morbid, maybe.
Well, the idea is that these short life stories expose you to really diverse experiences, jobs, hobbies, connections, things outside your usual bubble. And that exposure to distant, unexpected ideas fuels novel associations in your own mind.
Ah, so it's about breaking out of your cognitive echo chamber. Unlike, say, Google searches that just reinforce what you already know.
Precisely. He cites research on creativity emphasizing connections between different concepts in the Google of the mind and older theories about creative people making more remote associations, like table makes them think food or mouse, not just chair.
Okay, I get the theory. Yeah. Like how Velcro came from burrs or Post-its from a failed glue. Unexpected connections. Exactly. The article talks about mapping properties or structures from one domain to another.
Right.
Like the chair pony example, borrowing attributes or relational structures.
So reading diverse stuff strengthens that mental muscle.
That's the claim. And obits, especially those little ones in the back of the paper for regular folks, are supposedly a really rich, concentrated source of that diverse, unexpected information.
He gave examples.
Yeah, a woman who founded the Spanish International Network, but was also into British mysticism.
Okay, that's a mix.
And this guy, Norton Garfinkel, worked on landmine detection, news search algorithms, a game called PLAX, self-checkout systems, and published LeMay's Parent Magazine.
Wow. Okay, that's eclectic. I see the point about diversity.
The advice is to read them slowly, notice details, ask why, try to connect themes back to your own work or life.
Not necessarily expecting an instant aha moment.
Right, more like stocking your mental pantry with varied ingredients so creative combinations are more likely later.
Fascinating idea. How did the HN comments react to this?
Oh, all over the place. A big concern was obituary rot.
Obituary rot.
Yeah, the fear that digital obits won't last. Unlike old newspapers, they might vanish, making genealogy harder in the future.
Ah, preservation. People suggested archiving them on archive.org.
Yep, and archive.ph. Worries about AI-written obits lacking soul. Ideas about deliberately committing obits to the Internet Archive.
Debates about digital versus physical archives, timestamping for authenticity.
It went there. And politics briefly flared up over a mention of a Republican landslide in an obit.
Always lurking.
On a personal note, someone made a website for their mother-in-law's obit, led to questions about longevity of personal sites and companies aggregating and selling obit data.
Hmm. The data side is interesting.
Philosophical points, too. Should everything be perpetually accessible? Someone cited the cheese and the worms, how seemingly minor records became historically vital.
Cultural differences came up. Germany apparently has more concise death notices than detailed obits for ordinary folks.
Contrarian view. People have a right to die, maybe a right to be forgotten. Counter, but not be forgotten.
Finding old stuff online is hard. Someone griped about Google. Try Yandex, someone else suggested.
Then people share their own idea-stirring hacks. Listening to interviews, NPR obits, Fresh Air, Studs Terkel, academic authors. Similar vibe of encountering diverse lives.
That makes sense.
An old Russian joke resurfaced reading obits just to see if certain people are dead yet, which felt relevant to some current political figures.
Oof. Someone clarified the joke was originally about Stalin.
But a lot of skepticism about the core creativity hack claim. Where's the proof? The anecdotes.
Right. It sounds plausible that exposure to novelty helps creativity, but did anyone say, I read an obit and invented X?
Not really. Someone offered a very tenuous personal example. Others said, well, maybe read anything. It's better advice. Debate about burden of proof.
Is it like take a shower, creativity advice, or needs more evidence?
Exactly. Links to actual creativity research were shared. The counter argument was obits are like accessible mini bios, easier than a full biography.
Recommendations for more reading on creativity, reading lists of famous people.
One critique said the article's definition of creativity was narrow and the link to obits wasn't convincing.
But an investor chimed in saying they do read obits, but as an opportunity radar. Looking for leadership changes, etc.
Interesting angle. Someone else just skips obits of people they don't know. A link to a new era obit service.
The core idea kept coming back. Encountering difference is key. Connecting with people unlike you.
Reading The Economist's obits was highly recommended. Apparently, they're very well written and available on their podcast, too.
Using obits for fiction character ideas? That seems practical.
Yeah, and the observation that real people are rarely flawless heroes. Good for writers. Norton Garfinkel having a Wikipedia page was noted, maybe not that unknown.
Some just saw it as a simple, nice, mind-stretching hack. Max Planck's quote about science advancing one funeral at a time came up.
Cynical, but maybe relevant question. Are full biographies better? Maybe, but obits are quicker. Someone joked they fit TikTok attention spans better.
Huh. And finally, a link to a documentary about the NYT Obit team.
So a really wide-ranging discussion sparked by that one article.
Okay, last one. Let's get back to pure tech headaches. Reverse geocoding is hard.
Yes. The pain of turning latitude and longitude back into a human-readable address. This blog post by Terrence Eaton is about his Open Benches project.
Open Benches. Crowdsourced memorial benches.
That's the one. So he has coordinates for benches, needs to show where they are in plain English.
Sounds simple enough. Aren't there APIs for that? OpenCage, OpenStreetMap, Stadia Maps.
There are. But as he found out, getting a useful result is tricky.
Where are the problems?
Two main things. First, getting a description that's accurate, but not too detailed. Like, you don't need the exact gate number for a bench in Kew Gardens.
Right, just Kew Gardens is probably fine.
Second, getting clickable address parts for filtering, like finding all benches in a specific city or county. Both boil down to precision and what the API actually gives you.
The raw data can be messy.
It's very. Lots of components, road, suburb, city, county, state, postcode. But not all countries use them. Or use them consistently. New York versus Berlin. Berlin was his example.
Some services try to format it nicely.
OpenCage has a formatter, yeah.
Yeah.
But the bigger issue for open benches is many benches aren't at street addresses. They're in parks, on trails.
So a house number is meaningless.
Exactly. So maybe use points of interest, POIs, like bench near Central Park.
But is that clear enough? Central Park, they plains, IL, USA is IL. Obvious to everyone.
Good point. And localization is another headache. Show Japanese addresses in Japanese. Transliterate.
And just because a POI is physically close doesn't mean it makes sense. The bench near the park edge, but the closest POI is a creamery across the river.
Right. Logically disconnected.
So what's a solution?
Pragmatism, yeah. Basically. Use Stadia Maps, get the nearest POI in English, combine the POI name with a rough location, city, country, save that as the address, and wait for users to complain. Huh. That ship it and fix it later approach. Understandable.
So how did the HN comments tackle this thorny problem?
Started with a fun fact. GPS coordinates change. Continental drift. Australia shifted 1.8 meters recently.
Whoa. So stored coordinates become inaccurate?
Well, it was clarified. GPS accounts for plate motion. The system updates. But it highlights that for things like property lines, you need fixed reference points, not just old coordinates.
The drift is like fingernail growth speed.
About 7 centimeters a year, yeah. Someone mentioned the Three Gorges Dam slightly changing Earth's rotation.
Crazy. Japan has to issue new coordinate systems after big earthquakes because the land physically moves meters?
Exactly. GDA 2020 in Australia is an example of updating these systems. Led to talk about handling historical data audit tables, temporal tables in SQL.
Someone shared a horror story from Taiwan. Google Maps API suddenly stopped returning the country code for an island county. Broke their app.
Ouch. They had to hack a fix using geographic boundaries. It just shows how complex mapping coordinates to named places is.
The perfectionist problem came up trying to solve every edge case versus shipping something good enough.
Yeah, and how ALMs might help but also introduce weird, non-deterministic errors. The tension between do it now and do it right.
Someone suggested free products often tolerate imperfect edge cases because they optimize for user count, not user satisfaction.
Interesting take. The sheer complexity of defining address was stressed. Link to falsehoods programmers believe about addresses.
A classic. Map data is constantly changing. Apparently, thousands of humans are still manually updating it. Automation can't catch everything. Local accuracy varies wildly.
Someone broke it down. 80% is calling APIs. The hard 20% is getting something useful with diminishing returns. Maybe LLMs help that last bit.
Genealogy folks have similar problems with ambiguous historical place names. Geocoding versus reverse geocoding distinction was clarified.
Google Maps API was suggested for getting ranked candidate addresses, but maybe overkill expensive if you just need the city.
Someone linked their custom solution using OpenStreetMap data, Python Squite, cheaper, maybe more tailored. S2 cells mentioned for indexing.
Navigation distance versus straight line distance. Useful, but adds complexity. Self-hosting Valhalla routing engine with OSM data for that.
Some cities publish seating data, potentially with addresses, but address formats vary wildly worldwide, China system as an example.
UX is tough.
Huh.
Maybe a crowdsourced feedback widget. Someone tried loading all of OSM into Elasticsearch. Geohashes as an alternative identifier.
The GeoNames database. Mentioned, but maybe not granular or up-to-date enough. for benches.
Maybe chop the long OSM address string into shorter bits for lookup, or just let users drop a pin on a map like Uber. Simpler UI map.name linked.
A GPS tracking app dev shared insights. Prefer structured data. Identifying address parts across countries is hard. Localization sucks. Bounding boxes help but aren't perfect. Benches are an unusual thing to locate precisely.
What three words came up those three-word addresses for 3 meter squares? But it's proprietary, has weird word combos. Google's Plus codes as an open alternative.
Someone misread the title as reverse genociding is hard.
Oh dear. Led to a tangent on spell check changing genocide to geocode. Yikes.
Directions using landmarks. Fine in grids, bad elsewhere. Final solution mentioned. Using global admin boundaries, gadiem.org, with PostGIS. It's just hard.
Wow. Okay, that really was a deep dive through today's HN Pod front page, April 27th, 2025. From Death Star lamps to text games, databases, obituaries, and map coordinates. Quite the range.
It really is. The goal, as always, is to pull out those surprising facts, those little insights you might miss just skimming headlines. Hope we manage that.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see the connections, or maybe just the sheer variety of things people are thinking about and working on.
Absolutely. You know, you look at the dedication behind that remote-controlled lamp. It's kind of the same spirit, maybe, as someone painstakingly building a text adventure in C or wrestling with the complexities of reverse geocoding.
That's a good point. Or even the idea from the Obits article, looking closely at disparate details to find connections. It's almost like what we try to do looking at these different HN posts, trying to see a bigger picture, at least interesting parallels.
Yeah. Like, does thinking about the ambiguity in reverse geocoding, how hard it is to pin down a place, change how you think about summarizing a life in an obituary? Both are about representing something complex with limited data.
Or does the close to the metal challenge of C programming resonate with the DIY hardware hacking of the LAMP project?
Uh-huh.
Different domains, but maybe a similar mindset of wanting to understand and control the underlying system.
Exactly. So maybe the final thought for you listening is, how do these different pieces connect for you? Did learning about the challenges of one area spark an idea or a new perspective on another?
Definitely worth mulling over. We'd encourage you to dig deeper into any of these topics that caught your attention. There's always more below the surface. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the HN Pod.